All right, welcome back or welcome to the North Star Method podcast. My name is Sebastian. I'm the co-founder and CEO of North Star Performance Psychology.
And I'm Sean, co-founder and director of mental performance.
On today's episode, we are talking about how pessimism is not the same as intelligence. It is not the smartest mindset that you can have. But what is it? Why are there so many people out there who are doomsdayers, who are concerned about the state of the world or their community or their performance? Is pessimism the same thing as being depressed? Is it something that you can think your way through? How can you design your life so that you believe no matter what, you can have a positive impact on the people around you and on your thoughts, feelings, and actions? That being said, there is a lot of research and background as to what pessimism is and how it opposes optimism, how it's related to skepticism. We want to give you a little bit of background so that you can understand what's actually going on in the mind and the body when you have a friend, a teammate, a coworker who just can't seem to shake that idea that things just aren't working out.
So yeah, one really important thing to keep in mind about pessimism is it actually comes from an evolutionary survival mechanism. We actually touched on this in episode 2 a little bit in the science of vibes, with this term we call neuroception, which is the brain's constant sort of scanning for danger and threat. Humans that were able to anticipate dangers, such as like predators, famine, poor living conditions, were more likely to survive. So that naturally kind of carries on. Luckily, we don't live amongst saber-toothed tigers anymore. And we're not always kind of in this immediate grave physical threat. However, that mental mechanism hasn't quite evolved past this neuroceptive tendency. And what is going on in our brains when this is happening? So it's actually funny. It's called the human default mode network. And it, as the name implies, this is the mindset that human beings default to, this neuroceptive kind of scan for threat. There are several sort of cortical structures involved in the default mode network, but the main one to think about here is the amygdala, which is kind of the fear center. It processes fears, threats, and it's more active, we find, in pessimists. The funny thing about pessimism versus optimism, there's another part of the brain that you might have heard of called the prefrontal cortex, part of the frontal lobe. This is actually responsible for kind of active thinking, regulating emotional responses and rational thinking and decision making. This default mode and the prefrontal cortex work antagonistically, which means they cannot be highly active at the same time. You can think about this like muscles, like your bicep and your tricep, for example. They're antagonistic muscles. If you flex your bicep, you cannot contract your tricep. It's fully elongated. And vice versa, if you're flexing your tricep, you can't flex your bicep. These mental muscles, if you will, work the same way. So you can kind of think about leveraging your prefrontal cortex and thinking for yourself and challenging the negative automatic thoughts, as we've kind of discussed before, as a way to kind of get out of a pessimistic mindset. But that is kind of where it comes from. And that is what's going on in your mind when you are experiencing pessimistic thinking, this overactivity in your default mode network, particularly the amygdala.
So sometimes it can be helpful to think of your brain as a computer. And if you have a laptop, you know that when you boot it up, certain programs automatically open. In your settings, in your computer, you can edit this. You can say, when I turn my computer on, I want my browser to open or GarageBand or whatever apps you usually use more frequently. The default mode network has evolved to activate the parts of your brain that are the most useful most often. However, now that we have this understanding of why those parts of the brain are thought of as the most useful, we can see that in a lot of modern situations, that default network is actually outdated. So can you actually reshape, the same way that you could with your laptop, the parts of your brain that are active in certain situations?
Absolutely. And understanding that this automatic negative thinking is there for a reason and, you know, is there to kind of tell you something is the first place to start. So awareness that the mind is going to go to these negative, maybe even unhelpful places on its own, being aware of that and then having the ability to sort of play lawyer or devil's advocate against the thought and kind of challenge its validity and try to reframe it. I call it like radically finding the silver lining a lot of times. For example, like a pessimist would say something like, God, I hate going to work. I got to get up to go to work today. This sucks. A radical reframe and find the silver lining is like, I get to go to work today. You know, I have a job and I have this opportunity to actually provide for myself. That would be a more optimistic way to look at it. And as we mentioned in an episode prior, like this, the repetition of the thought, we use the name example. You're going to respond to your name without thinking because of how many times it's been repeated. Again, this is kind of how the brain works. The more you repeat and the less you challenge the automatic negative thoughts, the more you're going to succumb and fall victim to these negative thoughts and these what we call cognitive distortions, these sort of irrational beliefs about the world that we develop through repetitive pessimistic thinking.
So the reality is that your brain is wired to look for the negative because it's keeping you safe. That's something that it's supposed to do. It's a feature, not a bug. But if you don't recognize that and you don't understand why it does that, then you're just automatically getting drawn into negative thinking all the time because your brain's trying to keep you safe. That being said, I think when a lot of people hear this, they hear, so you're saying when I don't want to go to work, I just need to think, oh, at least I get to go to work. And that doesn't have an immediate positive impact for them. How do people kind of understand that thoughts are not a quick fix? They're the beginning to rewiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. It's understanding how like developing new thought patterns and legitimately neuropathways does take time. Like we often use the example or rather the analogy of mental training and physical training. If you are extremely out of shape and you go to the gym and do one workout, you're not going to feel perfectly or better. Like it's just not going to happen. Like you might feel a little bit good after the workout, you might feel super in pain, but you're not going to have a six pack after, right? It's kind of unfortunately the same way with mental training. You always say mental skills have a reverse tolerance, and the more you train them, like the less you train them, the less effect it's going to take. The more you train them, the more effect it's going to have. And further, the easier it's going to be to recall and call upon these mental skills. It's understanding that this mindset is the way it is right now. Your name is your name right now. If you were to change your name, you're not going to have this response immediately. It's going to take just an accepting and embracing the intentional efforts to rewire these thought patterns. And understand that it's not you. It's not a you thing. It's a human being thing. And understanding that this is the kind of that default software that we have in our mind's mental network, whatever. But you have the ability to change that over time with intentional effort.
So this is a huge advantage to anybody that realizes this, because for whatever reason, the majority of the world has not yet. Training mental skills is the same as training physical skills. It doesn't work on the first rep, just like getting better at bench press doesn't happen with three sets of 10. And so a lot of times when people hear about mental skills, they think, oh, well, I tried it a couple times and it didn't work for me. And the truth is you got to train it just like you do in the gym. The good news about training mental skills is that it takes a lot less time than the gym does. So you don't have to drive anywhere. You don't have to develop some super extensive routine. It's just something that you have to practice consistently. And we want you to understand that, because if you start training that now, not only are you going to be able to rewire away from natural pessimism to a competitive advantage optimism, but you're going to be able to build strength across a bunch of different areas of psychological skills, where the vast majority of the world is looking at it and saying, yeah, it just doesn't work for me. They just haven't done it enough times. You had mentioned cognitive distortions. And basically what these are is patterns in our thinking that are usually associated with that default mode network, that are built to keep you safe and alive. Why is it important for people to understand what the cognitive distortions are, and how does that impact some common kind of situations that people run into?
Sure. So there's probably at least like 10 examples of cognitive distortions, but understanding that these are just default ways of thinking that are, again, like you said, protecting you from threat and not necessarily based on rationality. I'll give a couple examples. So one that I see in my work a lot with athletes is a cognitive distortion known as overgeneralization. This is drawing broad conclusions based on a single event. And this single event might have been, you know, particularly traumatic and more impactful for that reason. So, for example, if you miss a game-winning three-pointer and your whole team is mad at you and the whole school or whatever fan base is mad at you, that's going to be particularly impactful for you. And so the next time you get into that situation, you're going to start to assume you're not going to make it, or you're going to want to avoid the feelings, the outcome that kind of came there. And you're overgeneralizing, like, I missed that shot, I'm not clutch. Like, no, you missed one shot. I'm sure you've made clutch shots before, or you're capable of making clutch shots, but you're overgeneralizing the results of a single event toward the potential results of similar events, when that's also kind of a cognitive distortion of what we call fortune telling, which is just predicting negative outcomes without any evidence. And you don't know that it's happened. How do you know that you're going to miss it, for example? Another big one is all or nothing thinking, or also known as like black and white thinking or dichotomous thinking. Seeing things, if I don't win, I'm a failure. Or if we lose this game, then we have no chance going forward, or whatever it might be. They fail to see the vast gray area between these two poles and understanding, hey, even if we don't win, there are things that I can learn from to help myself and my team develop. Seeing kind of, again, radically finding that silver lining, looking into the gray area rather than avoiding that all or nothing thinking. These cognitive distortions, if not checked, and like if you're not aware of the effect and the presence of them, they can spiral you into this like chronically pessimistic mindset.
So the theme that I'm seeing between the few distortions that you mentioned just now, overgeneralization, or nothing thinking, fortune telling, is that there is like a low tolerance for uncertainty. And you will notice that cognitive distortions are all based on filling the gaps where you don't have all the information. And this, of course, draws back to the evolutionary perspective. If you didn't really know what was going to be in that cave, it was better to play it safe.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times in life where if you have a lot of unknown in a situation, playing it safe is the better strategy. However, it's not the strategy that is going to help you fulfill your potential or have even just the most fun that you can have. And so as you observe your mind when you get into uncertain or difficult situations, what you want to be looking out for is your relationship to uncertainty. And pessimism looks at uncertainty and says, it's probably not good. Optimism looks at it and says, hey, I don't know what's going to happen. That means great things could happen. And again, we're not telling you to throw out skepticism. There's a healthy middle ground where you still approach uncertainty with caution without throwing away opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes to sort of what we talked about last week or 2 weeks ago, that curiosity versus judgment piece. Like, go into the uncertainty, the novelty, the new kind of situation that you don't know what's going to happen with this mindset of curiosity. Hey, I don't know what's going to happen. That's exciting. Maybe I can do my best here and try to do my best to facilitate the best outcome possible. That would be a curious and optimism leaning mindset. Whereas like pessimism would be like, oh shit, like, I don't know what's going to happen. Why even try? Let's just avoid this because it's probably going to end up poorly anyway. And again, pessimism and skepticism is kind of a line to walk. But if you're always defaulting to pessimism and falling victim to these cognitive distortions, like you said, you're never really going to grow or reach your potential or actualize.
Another cognitive distortion to look out for, following this theme of curiosity versus judgment, is labeling. So you want to get really good at noticing when you issue judgment automatically, when it's your knee-jerk reaction. And one of the more common scenarios in which that is exemplified is putting labels on yourself or others based on a single event. And one of the first things that you learn in almost any psychology class is called fundamental attribution error. It's just misattributing something to disposition over situation. So for example, I missed a shot, I'm a loser, or I'm not a good athlete. This could go for specific skills within your sport. Maybe it's like, you know, I'm great at run blocking, but I'm just not a great pass blocker, or I'm a good role player, but I'm just not great at being a team leader. How do you meet a label with curiosity instead of judgment?
So it's important to keep in mind, like you mentioned, attributional style, and understanding how pessimists look at things versus the dichotomy of how optimists look at things, and then being able to, again, like toe that line with a healthy amount of skepticism. So pessimists tend to attribute things to internal, stable, and global factors. Now, what that means, internal factors is like a negative result is all my fault, or like I am responsible for this bad thing. Stable factors means it's kind of unchangeable. It's always going to be this way. Like you mentioned, I cannot run block. I cannot pass protect. I'm only good at running. I can't catch the ball out of the backfield. And then global, like this affects, this one event affects everything. Because I'm not able to develop skills in this, everything that I have is, every skill that I have is fixed, and I'm not going to be able to grow. This contrasts with optimists who see the world or see failures as external, temporary, and specific. So external, failure might have not been my fault. Maybe I didn't prepare enough, but maybe there's some other things that happened too. Temporary, hey, this failure just happened. How do I know that a failure is going to continue to happen if I don't apply myself and actually actively try to work harder? And then specific, like this failure just happened because of these reasons. It's not some sort of like global trend that we should kind of be overthinking about. So kind of understanding this dichotomy and be like, this is the thing, the ways that pessimists think, and this are the ways the optimists think, can help you shift away from the pessimism and more towards the optimism. So a lot of times, the more we challenge these thoughts, the more we do find that they're not based in rationality. Like, okay, like maybe this actually doesn't make sense, but it's hard for us to kind of emotionally detach from these thoughts, which makes it difficult.
So by now, it's very clear that you have a lot of control over whether or not your attitude is pessimistic or optimistic. And being optimistic is one of the key traits of being a high performer. There is a performance psychologist, Michael Gervais, over at Finding Mastery, who often talks about how all the best people in the world, all the people who are achieving great things and living fulfilling lives, none of them are pessimists. They're all optimists. And that is characterized by a fundamental belief that I just think things are going to work out. And so when people are hearing this, now they have an awareness of why pessimism is kind of automatically wired into the brain. They also might be thinking, well, aren't there things that we should be pessimistic about? I mean, bad things happen.
Sure.
And, you know, if, especially if you're of high IQ and you're well-versed on history, you do a lot of pattern identification. So you say, you know what, we've seen this before. We know how this goes. People in this situation usually don't get out of it. Societies at this stage usually go in this direction. What do we say to those people who their pessimism is not just an automatic thought? It's a very logically constructed argument based on intelligent thinking.
Well, the funny thing is, IQ is actually positively correlated to neuroticism, which, for those of you who don't know, neuroticism is proneness to negative thinking or negative emotions like anxiety, depression, etc. So the more you are good at thinking, a lot of times, the better you are also at overthinking. And like you said, there are things worth being pessimistic about, or at least skeptical about. You don't want to just be blindly optimistic to everything, because then you're never going to anticipate any kind of threat or any kind of challenge. I think it just kind of goes to understanding that it's a signal. Like, even anxiety and certain emotions, every emotion that we have is a signal. There might be a reason to be scared, and maybe the stimulus in the environment that caused the thought and the feeling that makes us feel anxious is similar to a stimulus that has been legitimate before. And so this is why understanding, okay, the default mode is active. We're thinking in this way. Let's check why. And this is the curiosity / skeptical approach, excuse me. Be like, okay, is there a reason to be scared right now? Is there a physiological threat in the situation? If there is, great. Escape it. Or like, do what you can to mitigate the threat. But often, the more we do activate our prefrontal cortex and just try to deactivate that amygdala, the more we find we're able to kind of see through the automatic negative pessimistic thought.
So if you are a high IQ individual, you probably are more likely to be pessimistic. And you're not logically wrong. You're going to look at situations and say, hey, this is likely to go in a bad direction. What we're saying is that pessimism may be correlated and may even be a sign of high intelligence, but it's still not the most helpful mindset for approaching the things that you're pessimistic about. And so if you can toe that line and make sure that you're more skeptical and not pessimistic, then when you approach these things that you think are going bad, you have a way better opportunity to actually do something good about them. And you have to make sure not to get too attached to an identity of pessimism. Like, yeah, this is just who I am, and this is just how I see the world. Because the reason that that's part of your identity is because it feels helpful, when the reality is that optimism is a lot more helpful and effective in that scenario. The reason it feels helpful is because you're basically skipping the uncertainty. And so the absolute smartest thing that you can do is to be okay with uncertainty, to get into situations where you don't know what the outcome is, where you don't know if things are going to go poorly or not, but to believe that you are somebody who can positively influence the situation, whether it's on a global scale or whether it's just on your team and your family and in your community.
So I have an interesting take on this, or a perspective on this, through the lens of people who recover from spinal cord injuries. So I like to attribute my success in my recovery, and I think the success in a lot of other people's recoveries, to a mostly optimistic mindset. And not to be naive, it's funny you kind of mentioned earlier the like difference between being naive and being optimistic. When I was coming up in the injury, I guess I should say, when I was first injured and recovering, I did have a naive level of optimism. I do believe I've always kind of been a positive, optimistic person. And that kind of blind optimism at the time helped. But, you know, as I've become more realistic, but more importantly, as I've seen other people and kind of had this perspective as they've been recovering from their injuries, I noticed the same trend. A lot of people that I know are natural pessimists, and the pessimism is protecting them. Why the fuck would I go to physical therapy for hours a day? Why would I do all this hard shit to not see immediate results, to maybe not even achieve my goals? I'm just going to do what I need to do to survive and like kind of accept this new life. And, you know, if you want to just optimize your life, you know, in your situation, that's fine. But if you do want to do and truly value doing everything you can to make the most of a shitty situation and get out of it and move forward, this optimistic mindset, this challenging the negative thoughts, is necessary, especially when every single medical professional in the hospital is referring to studies done by people that you believe to be smarter than you, telling you that it's pretty much statistically impossible or just wildly improbable. So I've found that optimism can cause these kind of spontaneous healing, these kind of mindset shifts towards like miraculous quote-unquote recovery. Now that mine's been miraculous, But you find the people who have this steadfast belief that they can do this. I am resilient enough to actually move past the shit situation and overcome it and be better because of it. You find that those are the people that make it out. You never hear about someone pessimistic and thinking they're going to die or not going to be able to overcome their situation being one of those success stories. So goes to show, like, might as well believe in something.
Yeah, you might as well, right? I think this touches on a broader theme of comfort versus growth. And it is very clear the more that you study people who overcome major adversity or people who achieve incredible things and make great comebacks, that they choose the discomfort of growth over the comfort of familiarity. And there's a lot of familiarity in pessimism because it believes that it knows how things are going to go. And if I know how things are going to go, then I don't have to worry about it. So in order to accept that you don't know how things are going to go, which means not only embracing the downside that it could go bad, but also embracing the upside that good things could happen, you have to have a healthy relationship with uncertainty. And part of that is what you say to yourself when you're in those situations. So is it, you know, okay, I notice that, like, I have a bad physiological reaction to uncertainty, like my heart races, I'm anxious, I can't sleep. Am I somebody who can handle that? Or am I somebody who shies away from it and doesn't ever want to experience it? Everything good in life comes on the other side of uncertainty and discomfort. And the higher tolerance that you have for discomfort, the more that you open yourself up to the upside of uncertainty, which is achieving things that are previously seen as maybe not achievable. I've certainly seen this in the chronic illness community as well, where, again, you make a great point. The science is against you. People who know way more than you and have been doing this for decades have empirical evidence that your situation and your outlook is negative. And as somebody who probably defaults more towards pessimism automatically, because I will look at all the evidence and I'll say, yep, this is how this is most likely to go. You know, that thought process has definitely snuck up on me and held me back at times. And it took me weeks or months to even realize what was going on. So all of this comes back to the importance of self-awareness. How quickly do you notice the direction that your thoughts, feelings, and actions are moving in? And the reason we want you to train awareness through meditation, through mindfulness, is so that you can notice when you're slipping into pessimism, so that instead of a week or a month, it's a minute or a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just the noticing. It's gaining awareness of your attention, really. Like, most people that I know, and this is no offense, but, like, they don't know what they're paying attention to. It's being controlled for them by their kind of automatic mind. And a lot of people, when they finally, like, gain awareness and understand that what they're focusing on is, like, leading to negative outcomes or negative feelings, at least, they're all motivated to change it. Or they all would, like, at least like it to not happen. And so the more that you can be aware that these things aren't always under your control, there's a lot of neurological mechanisms guiding your feelings, guiding your focus for you because of the way that we've evolved. And that's okay, but you do have the ability to kind of take the self-command and redirect the direction of that, of those mental mechanisms.
And not only is it the internal default to focus on the negative and to be pessimistic, but the external environment that we live in now has never been more conducive to moving your attention towards the negative, whether that's the algorithms on your social media or the headlines in the news. And so it is more important now than ever for you to reclaim attention, reclaim control of your focus, so that you can notice how you're being manipulated by these sources and then make them work for you. If you are scrolling and using the algorithm, the more that you notice where your attention is and move it away from things you don't want it to be on, the more it will respond to that. So you've seen it online, like, people will do an experiment. I saw a guy who was like, I tried to get my algorithm to show me nothing but eggs, and then his whole, like, feed was just like people frying eggs and, like, if you notice what you're getting sucked into and cut that short more often and refocus on what you want to, then your algorithm will shape to that as well. So you have so much more control over these things that you think are controlling you than most people realize.
And you can think about the algorithm in like an external, like a life algorithm manner, like how you are, what you're focusing on, what you're saying to yourself repeatedly is gonna like shift the algorithm of what you perceive in your life. If you're constantly telling yourself that like you are the person to like achieve your goals and you have the belief in yourself and everything is going to be presented to you and the opportunities that are presented, you're going to capitalize on, the more you're going to notice positive opportunities. One of these cognitive distortions is mental filtering and filtering, emphasizing the negative and discounting the positive. The more you can tell yourself that like things are good and like today's going to be a day where I, you know, make moves in the directions in which I want to go, the more you're going to find these opportunities, the less you're going to filter negatively, the more you're going to filter positively. So think about like what you're focusing on, what the inputs are and what you're saying to yourself and how that is defining the algorithm, if you will, how that's defining the filter through which you operate and just perceive life.
So now that you understand the science of pessimism, the default mode network and cognitive distortions, you are empowered to have control not only over the algorithms on your phone, but the algorithms in your mind. You can shape them to show you the content that you actually want and need to see, and not just the brain rot and the negative thoughts. And all of the best people in their fields, whether it's in sports, business, music, have wired their algorithms internally and externally in a way that helps them move in the direction of a life that they want. So you absolutely have control over this. And if you feel that you're stuck in a pessimistic mindset right now, you don't have to make a massive change. Just start with one thing. Just try to notice how you can reframe small inconveniences to highlight things that you're grateful for. And again, a lot of people are going to hear this and say, I did it a couple times and it didn't work. Do it all week. Like, when you spill a drink on the floor, this sounds crazy, but just the fact that you have a floor, that you have a house that you get to clean up. When you first think it to yourself, it's going to be like, all right, that's kind of funny, kind of silly. But the more that you do it, now, like every time that you make a mess, you get to reflect on the fact that you have somewhere to live, which, although is a very basic thing, is something that we often take for granted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I notice this in my life all the time. It's like a very, I guess, cliche, for lack of a better term, example of people who like wake up and like, oh, I have to do all this today. Like, at least you get to wake up is kind of the grateful reframe there. For a long time, I couldn't get up. Like I couldn't get out of bed myself for, I want to say, like 3 or 4 years. And that was, keep in mind, if you didn't listen to episode one, I strongly suggest you tune in, at age 17. So from age 17 to 21, I couldn't get out of bed without help. You can think about how that impacts your independence, but and your thoughts on yourself as like a human being, and at that point, like a young developing man, it doesn't feel that good. But after 5 years, I was able to get out of myself. I figured it out and like was able to get strong enough and just have enough reps to where I'm so fucking grateful to be able to get up every morning. And I feel that more than probably 90% of people on this earth. And I don't want to generalize there, but like, it's just one example. Like when I'm, you know, stressed about a work thing or a relationship or just something going on in life, like it does help to think about like, hey, you're living a normal enough life now that these normal stressors are getting at you. Like for a while, my biggest stressors were, will I ever be able to live independently? Will I ever be able to move this muscle again? And, it's funny now, like I'm stressing like a normal person. I shouldn't say normal, like a typical able-bodied person would. And what helps me most is reflecting back on when I couldn't even feed myself.
And that really is the definition of optimism, which is that these normal day-to-day stressors that we experience, and certainly stressors that high performers experience, like losing a game on national television, are a privilege. And there's a lot of focus these days on privilege and who has it and who doesn't. And there's no question that we live in a world where things are not fair. Mm-hmm. However, it helps you and is in your best interest to focus on the abilities that you do have. And not only does it help you do things like recover from the greatest adversities that you faced, but it's also the reason why the entire stadium and the camera always panned to Tom Brady when he's down 10 points with 2 minutes to go.
Yeah.
It's, and you know, the same thing goes for guys like Mahomes, right? When you start to focus on your ability, even when you're down, everybody else does too. And there's this like self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Where you can call it manifesting, you can call it what you want. At the end of the day, if you believe, other people believe. And when other people believe, that strengthens the cause. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to be a leader, a team captain, if you want to start a family, if you want to start a business, being an optimist isn't just a performance hack. It's a requirement.
Necessity.
It's essential.
One thing to touch on with that belief in your ability, like, am I going to be able to actually do this beat? This belief in yourself defines how you operate every time you're faced with a challenge. And you and I have joked, just like talking off air, about how I think I have done the hardest thing that I'm ever going to do. Like, recovering from a C5 spinal cord injury is the hardest thing that I think I'll ever do. And now every time I'm confronted with a challenge, whether through school, grad school, work, life, whatever, I do always have in my back pocket that it's not going to be harder. And I've overcome harder. I know that I'm able to deal with hard shit. And what our kind of vision is that not everybody has to go through a life-threatening injury or one of the most significant adversities that you could possibly go through to be able to develop the mental resilience and skills to be able to do hard shit. And so that's kind of the world I would like to live in. It's like, a lot of time there is a lot of inspiration from people who have injuries like mine or survive terminal cancer or achieve these seemingly insurmountable feats. What we would like to do is have people kind of gain the mindset and the mental tools and skills that that kind of thing brings you without having to go through such a shitty situation.
Yep. Adversity is our greatest teacher, but it doesn't have to be our only one, and we can learn from other people's too. A lot of what we do is dissecting the mental skills that go into overcoming these adversities so that you can have the benefit without having the burden. And that's a great gift. So at this point, you are probably feeling a mix of empowerment in terms of the fact that you can overcome things and that optimism is something that you can wire into your brain, but also a feeling of responsibility where it's like, wow, this is a lot of work. And that's why we always want to encourage you, you know, if it feels overwhelming, to thin slice it. Just take it down to one skill, one practice, 1 week, whether that's looking for gratitude and inconvenience, or whether that's just watching highlights of, you know, the GOATs overcoming major deficits in games. Do things that are small, but that will snowball into building a optimistic mindset going forward.
Snowball is the key, the operative term here, is making a complete 180 lifestyle and mindset shift is just prone to not working. What we want to do is make a realistic kind of baby step to build momentum or snowball, if you will. Once we kind of talked about this, I guess last week too, is the more you feel the dopamine that comes from making the change successfully, like doing the thing that you're said you're going to do that moves you in the more helpful direction, the more motivated you are to keep going. That's where that snowball effect comes from. It's like the more release of dopamine, you want to keep chasing that direction and that feeling. And that is why like the thin slice approach is really the most effective to these mindset changes. The cold turkey approach, it just doesn't show to work very well.
All right. So that brings us to how we're going to end this episode. This is our Q&A segment. Some of our clients have priority access to submitting questions for the Q&A. We have so many of them that we might have to do entire episodes just on Q&A. Yeah,
we might have to do a Q&A show.
But for today, if you're interested in getting your questions answered, you can go to NorthStarKnows.com and inquire about signing a deal with North Star, becoming a North Star athlete, or whether you're an artist, an executive, or just a day-to-day person. We have a way for everybody to get involved so that you can build these skills, be part of a community of people who are doing it too, and get access to future features and updates. We have a lot of things in the pipeline, whether it's more hats, more merch drops. We're developing the North Star app right now as we speak, and our members will get priority access to all those things, including the Q&A. So that being said, let's take a couple questions from it.
Here, do you want to start? Or do you want me to start? I have a good one for you. Because I think I might know what your answer is. Do you have a go-to hack for getting into deep focus quickly?
So we live in the age of distraction. We talk about it all the time. And the odds are at some point today, you were lost in scrolling and didn't even realize it. So many people will pick up their phone to do one thing and then find themselves on social media without even thinking about it. How can you get into defocus quickly when you have a lot of work to do and you're feeling tired and it just feels like an uphill battle? This is a two-part answer. So the first, and this is the easiest mental skill that we have, it's binaural beats. So these are, we talked about this on episode 2.
Yeah.
These are frequencies that you can listen to in your headphones to help sync your brain waves to the state that is most conducive to the activity that you're doing, whether that's relaxation, meditation, focus, working out. We will be putting custom binaural beats in the North Star app specific to certain scenarios like pregame warmups or going into the studio to record. But what I'll do right now, if I'm feeling like I can't focus and I just need to get into it, I will do 5 minutes of eyes closed meditation with a binaural beat at a frequency that is set for focus. And it's important that you meditate with it before you hop into it, because this is priming the state before you get into the activity. You also need to remember that you're not going to feel it immediately. So this is something where you kind of prime it. And then once you start, you slip into it. So don't expect to feel focused before you focus. You have to start, but then those beats are there to like roll you down into it. A broader scale hack for focus. In those first 45 minutes of the day, your brain is in a very impressionable state. And what you prime it with during that time can affect, speaking of distortions, the way that you filter the information that your brain is processing throughout the day. And so if the first thing you do is pick your phone up, you're automatically going to prime your brain to look for your phone all day. If you put meditation with binaural beats at the start of your day, you prime focus. So it's a 5 minute, 10 minute activity that can influence the rest of the 24 hours that you have.
I did have one question. We did talk about binaural beats on episode 2. You mentioned, I was actually meaning to ask you about this off air for myself, but you mentioned putting binaural beats behind music.
Mm-hmm.
What actually do you mean by that? How do you do that?
So some apps will let you do this, some won't. And this is why the North Star app is going to be so helpful. But you can play binaural beats behind music to kind of double that effect. And there is a proportion that you want it to be at. So last I checked, if your music was at 100, you'd want the beat at 40%. And so you want to scale that ratio down.
So
can
you hear the beat?
Barely. Yeah, barely. Okay. But you're definitely not cognizant of it once the music's playing. And you also want to know like what music is good for you. So like when I do deep work, I put on, I'll shout out an artist called Medicine, who has an album called Sounds, and it's basically EDM, but like ambient music for focus. But if I'm working out, like I'll put a binaural beat behind rap or behind rock or whatever it is. So.
So you have like there is an app or something that plays them both simultaneously.
They do exist. There's not a lot of great ones, and so we're ready to bridge that gap in the market. But yes, you can pair them together.
I always like to listen to, you know, Grammatic.
No.
Artist. He's like a EDM, but like kind of musical integrity is a big part of his kind of vibe.
Okay.
Do you know who Grizz is?
Yeah.
So he makes music with Grizz a lot. And he has this song called Muy Tranquilo. And that is my go-to. I play that when I start to work. And so I'm going to put a binaural beat behind that. But okay, question one in the books.
All right, question number two. What is one piece of advice that completely changed the way that you think about performance?
There's a few that come to mind, but I'd say the first one that happened, like the most impactful first thing, was performance happens in the present. So we often talk about present moment focus and not thinking about outcomes or past failures or whatnot. But one thing that kind of operationalized this quote, if you will, you have like 100% of your cognitive or mental resources to allocate towards like a certain event, a certain performance. Ideally, you want 100% of those mental resources to be focused on executing the task at hand, executing your process to the best of your ability. This is how you get into a flow state, when 100% of your focus is just on the task at hand. We often find that X percent of that focus does drift toward the result, does drift toward what if we don't win, what if this is a game impacting mistake. And that is what brings you away from like thriving and actualizing and optimizing your performance. So understanding that performance happens in the present moment. The more you think about the future or the outcome, the less you're going to influence an optimal result. That landed with me a lot. And then it goes to, what do we do to train present moment focus, mindfulness, meditation, etc. So that was the big one for mine. I'm hoping it wasn't the big one for you, because I'm going to ask what advice did that for you.
So the thing that had the quickest impact on my mental performance was the distinction between emotions and feelings. So emotions are physiological phenomena, right? These are things that happen in our body and they're universal. So every human is wired to have them, whether that's fear or anger or excitement. And they're characterized by physiological changes, whether that's in your heart rate, in your breathing, in your skin conductance. What I was told is that the physiological emotion of nervousness is identical to the emotion of excitement.
Yep.
And basically, that means that a feeling is what you tell yourself about an emotion. So it's your subjective experience of the objective physiological phenomenon that the emotion is. And at first I was like, okay, great, like, interesting. But I'll never forget, it was my first presentation in grad school, and it had been a while since I had spoken in public, and I was really nervous, really wanted to make a good impression. My heart was pounding out of my chest. I was thinking, like, there's no way they're not going to notice that I'm nervous. And then I just remembered that idea, and I just told myself, like, man, I'm fired up. And I just started to say this myself, the things that you would say when you're excited, like, finally, the day is here. I've been waiting so long for this. I'm so ready to get up there. And it actually helped. Like, it sounds so simple, but it made a huge difference. And I crushed the presentation way better than I thought I was going to do. I was so worried about, like, is my voice going to sound shaky? Are people going to notice? But as soon as I stepped up there, reframing the emotion into the feeling of excitement actually helped me be more present. And I definitely got into the flow, because, like, I barely even remembered the presentation. I just, like, went. Like, yeah. I didn't think about it. It just happened, and I did get 100%. So
Well, yeah, it's that is such a good answer because the excitement versus nervous dichotomy is something we find a lot. And really what they both are just spikes in your sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
And an excited feeling remains in this like sweet spot, this individual zone of optimal functioning. Shout out Artur Pashpravowski,
yeah,
our professor for that term.
Stud.
The best. And what makes the difference whether you feel nervous or excited is how you're psychologically perceiving the situation. So the more you actually tell yourself, like you said, like, hey, this is excitement. This is actual energy that's going to channel me to get through this. The more you do that, the more helpful it's going to be. There's one kind of aphorism that I use, and it's a little corny, but it just like, I really like it. Butterflies, i.e. nervousness, are not necessarily a bad thing. You've probably heard nerves are not a bad thing. They increase your attention on the task at hand. They heighten your senses. They actually get you energized to execute the task at hand. When you're overly nervous or anxious, those butterflies are flying all over the place in your stomach. What you want to do is train the butterflies to fly in formation in you to help carry you through the performance. I know that sounds a little bit corny, but like, how do you get the butterflies to fly in formation? That is through your self-talk, through what you're focusing on, through your ability to self-regulate. So yeah, that was just a great kind of point to touch on.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to have things to visualize when you want to turn an emotion into a feeling, or basically when you're using self-talk to take how you feel in your body and turn it into something you can use in your mind. Having something to visualize is a very helpful tool that gives you leverage over that.
Mm.
So now more than ever, we live in a world where people are feeling pessimistic. And while their feelings are valid, they are not the most helpful.
Mm.
Being optimistic is not only something that helps you be a better performer and overcome deficits at halftime, it's also something that can help you turn the greatest adversities in your life into your greatest strengths. And you have complete control over this mindset. Even though you are automatically wired for pessimism, it doesn't take a whole lot to rewire yourself to see the world as a place where good things happen and where you can make good things happen. That being said, if you are interested in learning more skills that can help you rewire your brain, we're always posting clips. You can follow us at North Star Method on Instagram or check us out at northstarknows.com. And if you're interested, again, in submitting questions for the Q&A, head to northstarknows.com and see if there's a way that you can get involved with us. We are always looking to work with good people, and we have a way to help anybody at any part of their journey train mental skills. That being said, a no-cost way to you to support our efforts is to like and subscribe, whether you're listening on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or now available on Amazon Podcast as well. Share it, repost it. We appreciate all the love and support. And as always, we will see you next week.
Super chill to believe in yourself. I love y'all. Peace.